From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember novelist Joseph Heller. His World War II novel, Catch-22, became an American classic, and the title of the book became a part of the American vocabulary. Heller died Sunday at the age of 76 from a heart attack. We'll listen back to his 1988 interview. Also, we meet Alan Ball, who wrote one of the year's best films, American Beauty. He's also the creator and head writer of the sitcom Oh, Grow Up. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Sweetest Punch, the CD featuring guitarist Bill Frisell playing the songs of Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, the State Department confirmed reports that suspects have been arrested in connection with a new worldwide terrorist threat and said they're believed to be part of Osama bin Laden's organization. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
This past weekend, the State Department said there is credible information that terrorists may be planning attacks overseas during the holidays, including New Year's. The department has warned Americans abroad to exercise caution and avoid large gatherings. Officials say the threat is ongoing. Department spokesman James Foley says the suspects arrested in connection with this threat are associated with Osama bin Laden. The United States has charged him with arranging the deadly bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa last year. Bin Laden is believed to be in Afghanistan, protected by the Taliban, the most powerful faction there. U.S. officials have met with Taliban representatives in New York and told them the United States will hold the Taliban responsible for any terrorist attacks carried out by bin Laden's network. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
The president of Chechnya has reportedly offered to take part in talks with representatives of the Russian leadership if the talks include the head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The ETAR TASS news agency said Chechen President Aslan Maskhadov made the offer during a telephone interview. Russian troops have encircled Grozny, the Chechen capital, choking off the flow of reinforcements and supplies to rebel fighters. Thousands of mostly elderly Chechens remain trapped in the capital, also running out of supplies. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak arrives in the U.S. today for 2 days of peace talks with Syria's foreign minister. The meetings are the highest level ever between Syria and Israel and could lead to the end of 50 years of Arab-Israeli military conflict. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Since Egypt made peace with Israel 20 years ago, Syria has symbolized continued Arab rejection of the Jewish state. If Syria now makes peace, it would shake up politics across the region. First, peace with Syria would almost certainly mean peace with tiny Lebanon, where Syria is the power broker. Syrian officials say they want Israel to withdraw simultaneously from the Golan Heights, captured in 1967, and from southern Lebanon, the last active Israeli-Arab battle zone. This makes some Israelis nervous. Despite repeatedly having proved their military might, Israelis feel their small nation to be vulnerable. Many saw good news in today's government-owned Syria Times newspaper. It said a peace deal would mean security and dignity for everyone, including Israelis. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The creator of the Peanuts comic strip has retired. Cartoonist Charles Schulz decided to stop drawing the popular strip after nearly 50 years. The 77-year-old cartoonist recently underwent surgery for colon cancer. Peanuts has run in more than 2,600 newspapers, reaching some 355 million readers in 75 countries. The Clinton administration has stepped up its threat to lead a class-action lawsuit against the nation's gun manufacturers. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
The White House says that, for now, it will try to negotiate a settlement with gun manufacturers. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Andrew Cuomo is playing a lead role. His agency is intervening on behalf of public housing projects where gun violence has been a problem. Cuomo says he'll begin aggressive talks with gun industry representatives in the coming weeks. And as he's inviting gun manufacturers to the negotiating table, he's sending them a warning.
Let there be no doubt, if negotiations are unsuccessful, we are wholly prepared to go to litigation through the housing authorities.
The threatened lawsuit is also giving Democrats some political mileage. Vice President Al Gore already has made gun violence an issue in his campaign, and House Democrats are hoping the issue will help them regain a majority in 2000. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Washington.
Faced with a transit strike deadline of midnight tonight, New York City officials are putting contingency plans into effect. 3,000 additional officers will patrol the transit system, and the city plans to expand ferry and van service. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has said it's unlikely that there will be a citywide strike, but he said there may be work stoppages. The Transit Workers Union is under a court order not to strike, and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has threatened that any worker violating the injunction will be jailed for contempt. The Dow lost 32 points today to close at 11,160. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree.com, an online loan marketplace that delivers up to 4 loan offers from national and regional lenders, on the web at LendingTree.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The phrase catch-22 has come to mean an absurd regulation or condition that leaves you trapped. The expression was coined by Joseph Heller in his 1961 dark comic World War II novel, Catch-22, about the absurdity of war. Joseph Heller died of a heart attack Sunday night. He was 76. As novelist E.L. Doctorow said to the Associated Press yesterday, when Catch-22 came out, people were saying, well, World War II wasn't like this. But when we got tangled up in Vietnam, it became a sort of text for the consciousness of that time. Heller's other novels include Something Happened and Good as Gold. He also wrote 2 memoirs and several plays. In 1981, he was struck with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a virus which attacks the nervous system and paralyzes the body. He recovered from the paralysis, although some of his muscles never regained full strength. I spoke with Heller in 1988 and asked how he came up with the expression catch-22.
I don't know where it comes from. I did not begin with that. In writing the first chapter, which was about 8 or 10 pages, I saw an opportunity to put in something, a catch. It comes from the phrase, there's always a catch to something, or there's just one catch. I decided on impulse to give it a number, so it would have the power of an official statute. I didn't know whether I would keep it or not keep it. Then in contemplating the second chapter and future chapters, I saw other occasions when that could be employed and to become a kind of mysterious philosophy, perhaps explaining events, but if not explaining anything, justifying any type of illegitimate action and converting it to legitimate actions. The number itself was of no significance to me, and for the 7 years I worked on it, it was called Catch 18. And then because Leon Uris was going to publish a novel called Mila 18, and Leon Uris was very famous and I was not, the publishers decided I better get a new title. And it was an editor who called me up one day and suggested, I think I have a number that's better than 18. He said 22, and I said, you're right. And it's better because it does reflect the repetitious or the repetition of dire events which occur throughout the book.
Why did you make it the catch that you did? In other words, the catch being that in order to get out of...
Well, that's just one use of Catch-22. Yeah. The one that's most frequently quoted is that a man doesn't have to go into combat if he's crazy, but as soon as he expresses a wish to get out of combat, that's proof of sanity. That's just one. To me, the more frightening one occurs toward the end, when MPs have come in and broken up a house and arrested people, and an old woman is left, and when you're Sally and ask them, how did they do it? Why were they allowed to do it? She says, Catch-22. And he said, did they read it to you? He says, no, they don't have to read it to me. And, of course, Catch-22 says they don't have to tell you what Catch-22 is about. And then comes the more dire line that says, Catch-22 says they can do anything to us we can't stop them from doing.
The absurdity of war was an idea really more associated with the Vietnam War than it was with World War II, the war that you were in and the war that Catch-22 is set in. Did you experience it as an absurd war when you were fighting?
No, in talking to students, I have to make a point of stating that Catch-22 was not autobiographical in the sense that the experiences, emotions, and attitudes of Yosari and other sympathetic characters were not my own at the time I was in World War II, and probably were not those of most people in World War II, because there was a uniformity of opinion, a sense of rightness and necessity about fighting World War II, which has not existed since and which has rarely existed in the past in American history. My impression, I was very young, as most Americans were in World War II, 19 or 20. So my impression might be misleading, but there was a sense of governmental efficiency. It might have been inefficient, but it was never silly and never as inhumanly corrupt or devious as the wars or the politics, political statements about the wars have been ever since.
You were a bomber pilot.
I was a bombardier, not a pilot.
Oh, okay.
A bombardier in the B-25s, which were medium bombers. I was overseas at a time when it was very safe, relatively safe for me. When I left, it became dangerous again, and before I got there, it had been dangerous. But I was a bombardier in the B-25.
Did your attitude toward being a bombardier and toward being in the military change as you got deeper into the war?
No, it changed in terms of my own personal experience. I was required to fly 60 missions, and most were relatively easy. In fact, if I went on what was called the milk run at the beginning, I was disappointed. The only thing I knew about war was an impression obtained from Hollywood motion pictures. And if nothing happened, I was disappointed. I wanted adventure. Late in my tour of duty on my 37th mission, I had some adventure. I saw a plane shot down and a man on my plane was wounded. And for the next 27 missions, I was in a state of consternation, which often approached terror.
So but
that did not involve questioning the necessity of that war or fighting that war.
You know, it's interesting to me. A lot of writers write a great war novel during their career. And something about war is that fighting in it gives you kind of great material if you're a writer. On the other hand, half of your generation is experiencing it at the same time, so you have all these other writers writing great novels about war. Was that ever a problem for you, knowing that you might have this great novel about war in you?
No, I didn't. It was not a problem. If anything, the very good, I hesitate to use the word great about any novel, including my own, but the very good and successful war novels were an inspiration for me and a deterrent. Now, we're thinking...
Deterrent?
Well, deterrent in this way, that Norman Mailer had written The Naked and the Dead almost 10 years before I began Catch-22, and James Jones in 1951 published the From Here to Eternity. Deterrent in this respect, that I was not going to write a realistic book about World War II because my own experiences were limited. I really don't like doing research. And they, each of them, and others... already done very well what they had done. There was no need for another novel that would duplicate those. So it was a guide to me, and I was seeking a... once I decided to write a novel, I didn't decide to write a novel until I was 30 years old, then the task came of what novel to write. And my major experience then was in World War II, so it would be set in World War II. But the fact that these other writers had done their work so well led me to seek an area in which a novel could be written that had not been, a kind of novel that had not been written, and that was Catch-22, which was inspired more by the post-World War, the attitudes of the post-World War, than by the actual situation of World War II or my own experiences in it.
You grew up in Coney Island,
yes,
which is most famous for its huge... amusement park, which is kind of past its glory days now. I assume it's still open. I haven't been back there
in a long time. Oh, it's open. But see, what most of the world doesn't know, it's also a very large residential area and has been. I was a mile away from the amusement area, but there was a very large, I don't know what the population figures were, but there was a very large residential Italian population in one part, and the other part was almost entirely Jewish. I mean, there must have been 25,000 or 40,000 or 50,000 families living there and regarded as a neighborhood, which had the advantages. Now, it was a low-income neighborhood then, but which had these very precious advantages of a beach, a boardwalk close by, which is most valuable in the spring and autumn and sometimes in the winter, and had this fantastic amusement park there.
Did you have this feeling that, well, most kids have the parachute jump within walking distance?
Yeah, the parachute jump came late in my experience. Native Coney Islanders always looked on that with disdain as being there mainly for tourists.
It was
not a particularly exciting ride. I grew up at the time when there were large amusement parks. Luna Park was one and Steeplechase was another. But they were there. And the rites of passage involved growing up, the time you went on the highest roller coaster, which was called the Mile Sky Chaser, and then you went on the most thrilling, which was the Cyclone. And after a while, you're swimming out a quarter of a mile or half a mile to the bellboy there. That's the way we grew up. In certain rides, we began disdaining it in earlier. Just the way we, if you wanted a hot dog, you went to Nathan's. You didn't go to Feldman's because Feldman's was German, and it didn't have garlic in it. It wasn't smoked.
The one book of nonfiction that you've written that I know of is No Laughing Matter, which
right.
is
yeah.
a very personal account of the period that you had Guillain-Barré syndrome,
right.
which is
mm-hmm.
something that was responsible for a rather long period of temporary paralysis. Would you just describe a little bit what Guillain-Barré is?
Well, Guillain-Barré is a disease of what's called the peripheral nervous system, which I now know constitutes those nerves which come out of the spinal cord and out of the brain. The tissues are inflamed. As they get inflamed, the nerve responses are diffused, and the muscles become weak. The muscles become weak because they're not being activated. And it leads, in its most extreme cases, to total paralysis, where the person cannot even close the eyelids, and is incapable of talking, and is on a respirator. Mine was a moderate case. There is no known cause for it, although it's often stimulated by a viral infection, although the virus doesn't cause it, which means it often follows inoculations. I did not have inoculations. It was kind of amusing in onset because I did not have any sensory disturbances. Many people get numbness and tingling and then burning sensations. I was paralyzed and needed care for about, I was in the hospital, two hospitals for close to 6 months, and then it was about another 6 months before I could take care of myself. I left the hospital in a wheelchair and needed my friend Speed Vogel to take care of me, and I hired the most charming of the private nurses I have to take care of me, and we're married now because that worked out beautifully for us. It's a very serious disease, a very expensive disease, and many people do not recover to the extent that I have. And because I was knew I was recovering, and because I was never in pain, and the idea came, I wanted to keep Speed Vogel with me through that winter, and a friend of his suggested, why doesn't he write a book about taking care of me? And he asked me, could he do it? And I said, no, but I think together we can do it. So we wrote alternate chapters of it.
You know, you describe lying in bed in the hospital and having your friends coming to visit you. One of those friends was Mel Brooks.
Right.
And he basically wanted to know, contagious, or would he get it?
Well, Mel is, I've known Mel a long time. Mel is acutely, he's not a hypochondriac either, but he is acutely alert to the possibilities of diseases of all kinds, and does really have medical dictionaries, and I believe, in truth, does subscribe to the New England Journal of Medicine and to Lancet, which is the English publication. So his first visit to me, really, he knew more about it than I did then, but I knew enough to know he knew a great deal about it.
Were you offended with him coming in and basically wanting to quiz you to see?
Not at all. Not at all. He was also coming to
I realize that. I realize that.
He's coming as a friend.
Okay. I hope this isn't too personal, so if it is, we'll drop it. But I know you married the woman who was your nurse.
Yeah.
Did you have to redefine your relationship after you got well and it was no longer a professional relationship?
I had been married a very long time to my first wife. We had been separated for years. First time in my life I lived alone was resolved. I would never marry again because of my... I didn't want to take the trouble learning how to live with somebody. Now, what happened, fortunately for me and Valerie, is that we were together day and night for close to a year. So by that time, we the nurse-patient relationship changed very, very gradually, and I knew her very well, and she knew me intimately as a result of taking care of me. No, it didn't change at all.
One of the things you're famous for is your sense of humor in your writing. Do you feel that having had a protracted illness has affected your sense of humor at all?
Not in the least, no.
Do you think it's heightened it?
No, it doesn't affect my humor. It's given me a much healthier attitude toward life. It takes a lot more to get me angry or to make me impatient than it did before. And I'm leading a glorious life now because God knows was finished. Now, I ran out of money while I was sick. It's a very, very expensive illness because it requires a long period of care in a rehabilitation hospital. But when, luckily, my hands came back first, I was able to resume writing. And when God Knows was completed and the publisher liked it, accepted for publication, from that time on, I'm living a more relaxed, happy life than ever. I do only what I want to do in a way of work, which is to write.
Yeah, have you changed the balance of work to leisure in your life?
No, my leisure is my work.
Uh-huh.
I'm fortunate that I have no interest in athletics and watching it or playing it. I'm bored stiff, as bored by the Olympic Games as I am by the presidential campaigning. What my pleasure is writing, and so in that respect, I'm extremely fortunate.
Joseph Heller, recorded in 1988. He died Sunday of a heart attack. He was 76. Coming up, guitarist Bill Frisell plays the songs of Burt Bacharach and Elvis Costello. This is Fresh Air. Popular as Burt Bacharach has been in the 60s and in the 90s as a composer of sophisticated pop songs, relatively few jazz musicians have played his tunes. One big reason for that, according to jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, is that Bacharach, as his own arranger, is so good at finding the right tempo, instrumentation, and overall mood for a tune, it's hard to beat or even tie him at his own game. Still, musicians keep trying, which brings us to guitarist Bill Frisell's new CD.
Guitarist Bill Frisell grew up on 60s pop music and has played vintage Burt Bacharach tunes live from time to time. He also has a healthy habit of stepping outside of jazz in search of musical inspiration, notably in recent years, into the world of Nashville studio pros. Anyway, the new album, The Sweetest Punch, features Frisell's arrangements of all the tunes Bacharach wrote with lyricist Elvis Costello for their 1998 album, Painted from Memory, plus this earlier collaboration, God Give Me Strength. Frisell's pool of musicians includes colleagues from various past projects, among them clarinetist Don Byron, alto saxophonist Billy Drews, and bassist Victor Kraus. Frisell is an original and influential guitarist with a flair for small group orchestration, but The Sweetest Punch is oddly underwhelming. A program of Elvis Costello Burt Bacharach covers makes marketing sense, not least because Elvis himself appears on two tracks. In fact, the CD is out on Decca as part of Costello's multi-record deal with Decca's parent company, Universal. One of the tunes he sings, called I Still Have That Other Girl, is a duet with Cassandra Wilson. You could be forgiven for wondering if the singers were in the studio at the same time, although I'm told they were.
I have to say that we should finish it now before we weaken, cause we already know this is wrong. I could give in. Sometimes I feel that I will. Despite the temptation, I try to be very strong.
The tunes Burt Bacharach wrote with Elvis Costello are okay, but hardly the equal of the classics he wrote for Dionne Warwick, Dusty Springfield, and Tom Jones back when. Beyond that, Frizzell and company sound weirdly unengaged with the material. Too often they improvise over the repeating vamps that introduce or cap a tune, while playing the meat of the melody pretty straight in pastel harmony. Those vamps can be quite catchy in themselves, and Frizzell gives them attractive voicings, but they don't give a soloist as much stimulation as a good Bacharach main melody, with its leaping intervals and unexpected twists. The end result is more background music than bold statement. It's like the musicians eat the parsley but leave the steak untouched. If you want to hear a better jazz program of Burt Bacharach pieces, you might try saxophonist Stan Getz's 1967 album, What the World Needs Now, reissued on CD a year ago. If you want to hear what Bill Frizzell can do, he's made a lot of outstanding albums, including Rambler, Lookout for Hope, Strange Meeting, This Land, Go West, and Nashville, among others. He also plays very well on Don Byron's fine new CD, Romance with the Unseen. Frizzell has made so many good records, this little misfire shouldn't harm his reputation one bit.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Putumayo World Music. Putumayo releases include Cuba, World Playground, and New World Party. Information online at putumayo.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Alan Ball about writing one of the year's best films, American Beauty. It's his first produced screenplay, but he's had years of experience writing sitcoms.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American Beauty has been named Best Film of the Year by the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures. The film won the Los Angeles Film Critics Association Best Director Award. American Beauty is also on Time Magazine's Top 10 list. My guest is the screenwriter, Alan Ball. It's his first produced screenplay, but he's had several years' experience writing for sitcoms. He's the creator and executive producer of the current sitcom, Oh, Grow Up. American Beauty revolves around two suburban families, and it's about alienation and loneliness and the ability to find beauty in the ordinary. Kevin Spacey plays Lester Burnham, a man who barely communicates with his wife, Carolyn, played by Annette Bening, has lost touch with his teenage daughter, Janie, and detests his job at an advertising magazine. In this scene, he's at the dinner table when he announces that he's made a big change in his life.
Janie, today I quit my job. Just pass the asparagus.
Your father seems to think this kind of behavior is something to be proud of.
And your mother seems to prefer that I go through life like a f***ing prisoner while she keeps my d*** in a mason jar under the sink.
How dare you speak to me that way in front of her? And I marvel that you can be so contemptuous of me on the same day that you lose your job.
Lose it? I didn't lose it. It's not like, whoops, where'd my job go? I quit. Someone pass the asparagus.
Oh, and I want to thank you for putting me under the added pressure of being the sole breadwinner now.
I already have a job.
No, don't give a second thought as to who's going to pay the mortgage. We'll just leave it all up to Carolyn. You mean you're going to take care of everything now, Carolyn? Yes, I don't mind. I really don't. You mean everything? You don't mind having the sole responsibility? Your husband feels he can just quit his job and you don't...
Will someone who's please gonna pay the pass me the
asparagus? I'm not going to be a part of this.
Shut up! I am sick and tired of being treated like I don't exist. You two do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, and I don't complain. All I want
is
the
same... Oh,
you
don't complain? Oh, please, excuse me. I must be psychotic then. If you don't complain, what is this? Yeah, let's bring in the laugh meter and see how loud it gets on that one. You don't complain.
Don't interrupt me, honey.
Now, are there publicists and stuff doing an Academy Award push now?
Yes, that's all underway, and that's very interesting to me because, I had never even... it's just a whole new world, and so there's a whole strategy and all kinds of things like that, and it's quite interesting.
Tell us what you can about that, about the politics and the strategy...
Well, you know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal within the industry. And, for my own self, I've been signing scripts to send to all these various places. And I've been asked to appear on certain panels and screenwriting things and that sort of thing. And I'm happy to do it because, I have sort of a real outsider mentality, like who sort of just all of a sudden lucked into, you know, being in the middle of this. And also I have a tendency to believe that the conventional wisdom of the way you approach screenwriting is not necessarily the best. So whenever I'm invited to go to those things and talk to aspiring screenwriters, I'm always happy to, because I wish somebody had, you know, said to me when I was, younger and struggling, you know, the traditional three-act structure is not the only valid way to write a screenplay.
And how do you think American Beauty deviates from that three-act structure?
Well, it doesn't deviate entirely. I mean, there are three acts, but it fools around with structure a little bit. And there's also not a very... I mean, I guess you could say Lester is the protagonist, but he's not a very... he certainly does a lot of things that you're not rooting for. I think it's a little more morally ambiguous. I think it goes into deeper territory. I think it's ultimately, hopefully, touches on subjects that you wouldn't necessarily see in the latest Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
The Kevin Spacey character works for an advertising magazine. Now, I know you worked for an advertising and a public relations magazine. What kind of work did you do for those magazines?
I was an art director. I was not a writer. I was an art director. I worked in the art department. I designed infographics in which I took meaningless information and made it look visually appealing.
What's meaningless information?
Oh, you know, just statistics. Just page after page after page of statistics about who watches what and who reads what. And it was my job to do to turn it into, you know, clever little illustrated charts and graphs.
Well, Kevin Spacey writes this great quitting letter to his boss. It's really nasty.
Mm-hmm.
Can you paraphrase the letter for us?
I think the letter is, my job consists mostly of masking my contempt for the people in charge and at least once a day retiring to the men's room where I off while I fantasize about a life that doesn't so closely resemble hell.
Did you think of writing letters like that when you were working?
You know what? All the anger of Kevin's character doesn't come from my time at the magazine, because that was actually a fairly, you know, as day jobs go, it was about as good as it could get. It actually comes from my own anger at, I was a playwright living in New York. I was producing work that I really cared about, not making a cent for it, but really being invested and passionate in it and loving it, and directing it and even sometimes acting in it. And then I wrote a play, and I was offered a job to come out to Los Angeles and write for television. My first 4 years in TV were in situations that, to a writer, to somebody who needs his work to be meaningful, even if only to himself, I was working in situations where that was really not possible, and I was so creatively frustrated and angry at certain aspects of the, just the nature of the work that I was doing, that's who Lester's writing that letter to.
And were these sitcoms that you were writing?
Yes.
Do you want to say which ones?
No, I'd rather not.
Right.
But they were situation comedies that were that totally revolved around the star of the show, and in each instance, the star of the show had total creative control, and that's very frustrating as a writer, because you become a stenographer, and when you're taking dictation from someone who really doesn't think like a writer or think like who basically looks at the show as PR for their own lives. There's a certain amount of frustration and rage that builds up in you, and at the time I was really frustrated, but in retrospect, thank God, because it fueled the writing of American Beauty.
You know what I thought was really funny? You know, when Spacey quits the job, he ends up taking a job at a fast food hamburger place.
Right.
And he says he's looking for the least amount of responsibility. I have to say, I so related to that. I would never do this, and nor would I want to work in a fast food hamburger joint, and especially for the amount of money that they pay.
Right.
But there are days, you know, when I wake up, and I'm sure lots of people do, and think, is there a way of going through life with a little less responsibility?
Oh, totally. I know. And you just want to, I relate to that every day, believe me.
And is it more so now that you're so successful with American Beauty?
I'm what I'm doing now is I'm executive producing a television show, which is a tremendous amount of responsibility, more responsibility than I've ever had in my life. And while I love it, there are certainly days when I wake up and I think, yeah, I wouldn't mind flipping burgers today. I don't want to go in and face this. But, you know, wishing to do something and actually doing it are two different things.
My guest is Alan Ball. He wrote the screenplay for American Beauty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Alan Ball is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for American Beauty, and he's also the creator of the sitcom Oh, Grow Up. The Kevin Spacey character gets a crush on his daughter's best friend, who, like his daughter, is still in high school. And
right.
It starts off kind of funny in the beginning and gets, you know, increasingly disturbing as the story goes on. And, you know, not being a guy myself, I wonder, do you think that this is an emotion that a lot of adult men end up having to deal with and repress? these you know, feelings of arousal for, you know, lovely teenagers who are their children's friends.
I think for Lester, he hasn't felt that way about any woman in a long time. And she reawakens a part of him that takes him back to when he was a teenager himself, and he basically had that sort of optimism and that sort of kind of energy that you feel when basically your whole life is ahead of you as opposed to most of your life is behind you. Not most, but at least, you know, half of your life is behind you. You're at a point where you think anything is possible as opposed to a point where you think, well, how can I, what kind of compromise can I hope to settle for? And while his obsession with her may not be healthy or appropriate, I feel like his desire to have to feel that kind of passion in life again is very, very healthy. And he gets confused because he thinks that she's the goal, but she's really just, in sort of Jungian terms, she's just the knock on the door. She's just the call to adventure. And he realizes that, of course, by the end.
In American Beauty, the teenage guy in the film observes life through his video camera. He's just obsessive about videotaping the world around him, particularly anything that strikes him as beautiful. And the video both preserves the moment of beauty, but it also frames it as it's happening.
Right.
Some people may think that seeing the world through a camera distances you from what you're seeing, but it seems to connect him with the world. Has writing ever been like that for you? Has it been either distancing or something that connects you?
Yeah, exactly. It's been both. And I think, you know, if anybody were to analyze me, they'd say that's what his camera represents is writing for me. But he says a very interesting thing in the scene where he shows her the video of the plastic bag. He says, video is a poor excuse, I know, but it helps me remember. And it's not it's not the video itself. It's the moment. And he wants to preserve the moment, but he knows that the video of the moment is not the moment. That's a very subtle distinction that may get lost in some people, but I think that's an important part of his character.
Do you ever think that if you didn't write something down, you'd be left with virtually no memory of it, no way of retrieving it?
I don't think that I think there'd be no memory of it, but there are certain times when I feel sort of like whatever that gateway to your subconscious is open. It's like, I got to do this now or I'm never going to be able to see the clarity of this moment as clearly as I see it now.
This videotape that you mentioned is a videotape that the character takes of what he considers to be the most beautiful thing he's ever seen, which is basically a trash bag being blown in circles by the wind on an autumn day, and there's leaves blowing around too. Why did you come up with that image as the most beautiful thing?
Because I had an encounter with a plastic bag in the wind outside the World Trade Center one day that was sort of, you know, it was sort of an epiphany, and very similar to what he experienced. You know, I'm sure a lot of people would look at that and say, well, that's completely insane. And maybe it is, but I don't feel like I chose that image. I kind of feel like it chose me.
What was so beautiful about it to you?
I don't know. First of all, it was so real. It wasn't artificial. It wasn't a beautifully composed painting or a beautifully airbrushed photograph or this perfect image. You know, it was nature. And plus
nature and junk.
Yeah, exactly. And literally, this bag circled me. It just kept circling me. And I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but it really, there was something profound in that moment for me, and I've never forgotten that moment, and it kind of like brought me to tears, and I can't remember exactly what I was going through in my own life at that time. I might have been one of those moments where, you know, watching a Burger King commercial would have brought
me
to tears.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was a profound moment, and it always stuck with me. And you know, there's a whole Buddhist notion of the miraculous within the mundane, and that's why I thought it was important that there is beauty in a piece of garbage flying through the wind. And I went, actually, when the movie opened in Toronto and I went up there for the press junket, there was somebody who said, I want to talk to you about that moment. I went, okay. And they went, He says it's beautiful, but it's garbage. And I said, yeah. He said, well, garbage isn't beautiful. And I went, oh, well, you know, I guess it's a question of perspective. That's kind of the point. He went, no, garbage is not beautiful. And I sort of went, okay. Thanks for clearing that up for me.
Did you go with the director, Sam Mendes, when that sequence was being shot? And
no, and I keep asking him how he shot that. And
yeah, because you have to wait for that perfect moment where that bag really is kind of poetry in motion.
He's very mysterious about how he got it. But, you know, I think it's because it's probably very, you know, mundane. There were probably like four people off camera with leaf blowers, you know.
Right.
But but he says, no, I don't want to tell you how I got that.
Oh, well, eventually you'll get it out of him.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there was anything that you were able to do in American Beauty that you maybe wouldn't have been able to do if you were working with, say, a more experienced director or a production company that had already made a lot of movies? Because you were all first-timers and, I guess, all willing to take chances.
Yeah, and I also think the budget of our movie was so small that that no one cared.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it had been... I mean, there was a point where there were a couple of big A-list directors reading the script, and that made me very nervous because I knew that if they signed on and then they started getting big, big movie stars on and the budget crept upwards, then everybody would get really upset about them, you know, really nervous about the material. And, well, can't, you know, it's so gross for him to be obsessed with a teenager. Can't they be college students? Can't they, or in their mid-20s and... You know, can't Lester and Carolyn be better parents to their children? Because they're just so unlikable. And you know those kinds of studio notes that you get all the time. And we were very lucky because we were very low budget, by mainstream standards. And we just sort of like floated under the radar there.
If I were writing a movie, I would sure want Kevin Spacey to be reading lines that I'd written.
Oh, just when we had the first read-through, just sitting at the table and hearing him read, you know, I went up to him afterwards. I said, well, that was one of the great joys of my life. Thank you.
What did he do with your lines that perhaps made you hear what you had written differently than you'd heard it in your own head?
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of what he did with them was exactly what I heard in my own head.
Uh-huh.
But he tempered a lot of the stuff, especially in the last third of the movie, and he made it really, really kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he found a kindness in that character that I guess always existed, but when I wrote it, I was in such a state that I was just furious with the world, and so I had always, you know.
This is back when you were writing for sitcoms and really
yeah,
angry.
Yeah. I would come home at 3 a.m. after having rewritten a script that, you know, a sitcom script, which totally did not need to be rewritten. And I would just be furious and exhausted. And I would sit down at the computer and just, you know, pound out American Beauty for an hour before I'd go to bed. But Kevin is an amazing actor, and people always ask me, did you have him in mind when I wrote this script? And actually, no, I didn't. I don't have actors in mind when I write because the characters themselves seem real enough to me. But when his name was mentioned, I was like, yeah, that's good. Get him. He'd be great. You know? And I can't imagine anyone else playing this role. It's like he was born to play it.
There's something slightly similar between your voice and his?
Well, people say that, and people also say that we look alike. Actually, my first day on the set, I drove onto the set, and the security guard said, Mr. Spacey, your trailer is over there. And I said, no, I'm the writer. And she went, oh, well, you have to park over there, like a mile away. And actually, some friend of mine came to the set when we were filming, and my friend Nancy said, it's freaky. It's so freaky. You guys are so much alike. I just have to take that as a huge compliment, you know.
My guest is Alan Ball. He wrote the screenplay for American Beauty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Ball, the screenwriter of American Beauty and the creator and executive producer of the sitcom Oh Grow Up. Another question about American Beauty before we get to Oh Grow Up. There's two fathers in American Beauty, Kevin Spacey and the father next door. Now, the father next door is an ex-Marine and into, like, strict discipline of his son and also very homophobic.
Right.
Which sets a lot of the story in motion. I know that you're gay. Does this, like, homophobic father reference come from someone in your family or just things that you've observed and know exist?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I grew up in Marietta, and I grew up in the in Marietta, Georgia. And I grew up in I came of age like in the early 70s, before, you know, Will and Grace and stuff like that kind of
right.
stuff. And I grew up thinking I'm a freak. I'm a horrible. I'm evil. And there are certainly members of my family, not my immediate family, but members within my family who were viciously homophobic and just kind of aggressively bigoted.
What did they say to you?
That's just the thing. When I see them, like, once every 2 years at a family reunion, they smile blankly and they don't say anything. But I know behind my back they're saying I'm going to go to hell and that whatever. I know those things are going on behind my back, but to my face, they're very polite.
Well, let me ask you about your sitcom, Oh Grow Up, which premiered in September. Tell us what the basic premise of what brings the characters together here.
The basic premise is two guys who have known each other from college and who have lived together since college. They're kind of in their mid-30s, and so they sort of function as an old married couple, even though they're straight. And their third roommate is another college friend who just recently came out of the closet and left his wife. He was actually married. So it's a married gay guy living with two straight guys who are married to each other. And then one of the straight guys discovers that he has a teenage daughter he never knew about. And he's been sort of living the Casanova horn dog lifestyle for, you know, 20 years. This sort of like a big wake-up call for him. It's loosely, very loosely based on my own experience living in a brownstone in Brooklyn.
And who was living in that house?
Me, some friends from college, and a dog named Mom, just like there is in the sitcom.
When Ellen came out and the plot lines changed on her show, it was quite controversial. And now it seems like every new show has to have a gay character.
Yeah, I don't know that every show has to have a gay character. I mean, I thought it was interesting. I put a gay character in my show because I thought it was interesting to have straight men and gay men living together and it just not being an issue. Because when I was living in the house in Brooklyn with straight men, it just never was an issue. And I think I just think that's interesting. And plus, if he hadn't been gay, it would just be another show about three dumb straight guys. And, you know, it's like, well, what guest star is what I'm going to date this week? But this just gave us more interesting territory and was sort of just more, I thought, more interesting to me as a writer. But I know what you're saying. It's like all of a sudden every show has a gay character.
I'm not accusing you of being a copycat. Don't get me wrong. but I'm wondering, did you get any objections from the network or the production company, or was it like, oh, of course there's going to be a gay character now, no problem?
Never from the production company and never from the network that we're on. I initially pitched to a different network, and they sort of went, well, does the gay character have to be gay? And I think they were saying that because they already had, shows with gay characters. And they felt like they had sort of filled that quota. They also said, does it have to be urban? Can we make it suburban? And on those two, you know, I basically went, yeah, it does have to be urban. And yeah, he does have to be gay. So we took it to another network.
And they accepted it?
Yeah. Yeah, there was never a moment's hesitation.
I saw an episode in your show in which the gay character, once realizing he's gay goes to a gay bar and figures that now he has to figure out how to be gay because everyone around him is behaving differently than he's used to.
Right.
Did you go through that? You're figuring, like, now?
Oh, well, sure.
To
I still do. I mean, I live in Hollywood, in West Hollywood. Everybody is, like, incredibly, you know, they they're all these buff muscle boys, and they have, you know, they live this lifestyle that I'm certainly not judging and saying it's not valid, but I look at it and that is so not the life I want to lead. And I feel like there are probably a lot of gay and lesbian kids growing up in America, and they see that, oh my God, you have to be all worked out, and you have to party every weekend, and you have to, you know, this is what it means to be gay. And no, that's not what that's what it means to some people to be gay, but it's not the only way to be gay, and to kind of judge yourself if you don't live up to that standard, I think is kind of ridiculous. And if that's sort of what that's about, because I'm never going to be one of those West Hollywood circuit boys. And frankly, I don't want to be. But I think that is the image that a lot of America has of what gay men and what gay men are like and the kind of lives they lead. And no, it's not like that at all. And that's why Ford is, of the three guys in the show, the most conservative. And
Ford's the gay character.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, in a way, not in a way, on every front, he's definitely the most conservative of the three characters.
Is being out in the business not a problem anymore?
Not if you're a writer.
Right, you're so behind the scenes. Who cares?
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
So unimportant. Who cares?
In a way, being a writer, being gay, has almost like a little added. It's like a little extra. You know what I mean? Because there's such a tradition of so many great gay writers.
Uh huh.
And there are a lot. You know, so it's not a problem for me being a writer. No.
Well, I wish you happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
And thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Alan Ball wrote the screenplay for American Beauty. It won the Best Movie of the Year award from the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunewald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, unearthing Jobaria and Suchomimus, the two new rivals to Tyrannosaurus rex. We talk with paleontologist Paul Serino about fossil hunting in West Africa. Join us for the next Fresh Air.